Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I'm here with Samantha Durbin, the author of Raver Girl, Coming of Age in the 90s. Samantha, thanks for being here with me today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Could you start by talking a little bit about why you decided to write this book about your experiences in rave culture and the rave scene in the 90s?
Yes, of course. So I am a writer. I'm a lifestyle writer. I had discovered that kind of in my 20s. And so I was lifestyle writing for various media and brands throughout my 20s. And then in my early 30s, I was just hanging out with some girlfriends. And I was telling one of my crazy raver stories from when I was a teenager raving in the San Francisco Bay Area, and the story about when I had a bad acid trip. And they were like, oh my God, like, that's so crazy, and like laughing. And I kind of realized then, like, wow, you know, I'm kind of comfortable telling these stories now, because I had a lot of shame in my 20s and guilt about my behavior, especially towards my parents. But then I was like, yeah, I was able to candidly talk about these experiences. And then I realized, like, you know, I have a lot, I have this interesting experience. Maybe my parents kind of always like nudged me, like, oh, are you going to write a book now that you're a writer? And I was like, I don't know why I'd write a book about. So it was like light bulb, like, let me see if anyone's written a book about this. And so I went on online and did research and saw that no female had written her memoir about what raver life was like in the 90s. And there have been lots of great books written about the electronic music scene and the drug culture of it all. And those are really great books, and they were really helpful for me to write my story. But none of them were just kind of coming of age stories, and none of them were written by women. So I was like, oh, well, you know, this is a voice. I just really felt that like calling, like, okay, like, this is a story I need to write. Let me, you know, attempt to remember all this stuff. So I started writing it about 8 years ago.
A couple of things with this. I'm wondering if you could maybe, for those folks who don't know much about it, sort of situate the rave scene, what, you know, in the 1990s in the Bay Area, sort of what that meant and what that looked like.
Yes. So I went to my first rave in January of 1996. And by then, the rave scene was like alive and thriving pretty much all over the world. It started in the UK in the 80s. And it was like very much a big part of like their club culture. And so I'd say it started there. There were also like some small pockets of it in like Ibiza, Spain. And kind of the definition was these nighttime get-togethers where people would hire a DJ, and you know, electronic music was like really starting to blow up at the time because of technology. And so kind of the definition of a rave is a nighttime through the night gathering of people who dance to music, and many of them usually take drugs, and it's this kind of like communal dance place where people could go and just be free and dance and have fun. And they were often illegal. They were just kind of thrown together DIY, and that was kind of like part of the allure of them. So when I started raving in 1996 in the Bay Area, I'm from Oakland, and my first rave was actually in Oakland in a abandoned warehouse. At the time, raves were still kind of underground, kind of hard to find. You had to call a hotline. We called them raver hotlines. You had to call a hotline to find out either the address of where the party was going to be or the address for the map point. And that point was actually another location where you would go first. And it was to kind of like try to throw off the police. It was to try to avoid any big crowds gathering. So people would kind of trickle into the map point, and then you'd pay for the party sometimes there and then get the directions. And then the party was actually usually pretty close to the map point. So my first rave, the map point was a donut shop, which was like very random and exciting. And it was also my first time doing acid. So it was a really big adventure, because not only was it my first time going to a rave, it was my first time taking acid. I'd already had some experience smoking weed, so I wasn't exactly straight edge. And yeah, so we went to the map point, got the directions, paid $5, and then drove over to this other area of Oakland, and it was just like all dark warehouses, and then we spotted a few people standing outside a warehouse, like they were probably smoking cigarettes, and that's how we kind of knew that that's where it was. And it was, you know, it was all very exciting, but it was very hush hush. And, you know, I can get more into my first rave, but that was, that's kind of how they went down. That's how, a lot of people got to the rave. And then when you get there, it's, in the case of my first rave, it was in a warehouse, which is kind of the classic image, of a 90s rave, is these abandoned warehouses. Certainly around the Bay Area, obviously, depending on where you lived, it could have been, you know, it could have been an abandoned restaurant. It could have been, I've heard about raves in like a marine mammal center, like, and I went to ones in roller rinks and some were in clubs. And so it was like any space that you could find that had a dance floor and DJs could set up some turntables. So my first one was like very much a kind of classic warehouse. And there was just a big room. It was very dark. It had just like lasers going off all around. And the DJ spinning records. This is when the DJ still spun vinyl. It was just this other world. Like, it felt like a dream. Like, I'd entered like a dream world where it was like, you know, everyone was dancing, everyone was friendly. There was this like energy that I'd never experienced before. It all seemed, you know, very exciting and promising for just, you know, something that was way more exciting than high school. And, Yeah. And so that night, and especially once my acid kicked in, it was even more fascinating. And then there was just one other room at that rave. Sometimes there's multiple rooms, and sometimes they play music in the different room, different kinds of electronic music. So in the Bay Area, there was a lot of house music. That was the style. And then they had other rooms sometimes that were like, some were techno, some were trance, some were jungle. So like, depending kind of on what your electronic music preference was, you could hear that in another room. But this one just had the one main dance room and then a chill room. And then the chill room is a place that sounds kind of like what we called it, the chill room. You would go and you'd chill out there. So it usually had more mellow music. The lighting was more like dreamy, you know, dim lighting still, because it was like nightlife. But there was often water and fruit, and sometimes they would have like massage tables and people could get massages. And chill rooms were very popular in the Bay Area. Apparently they didn't have chill rooms in every rave scene. So I don't know if it was just like California, like kind of the new age California creeping in there, probably. But it was lovely, the chill rooms, because then the music wasn't as loud and it wasn't as crazy. So you could actually talk to people. You could meet friends, you could just like be really high and just kind of relax more, you know, find a sofa. So yeah, so there was a chill room at my first rave, and it was just like a whole nother kind of door in this world to discover and meet people. And that was kind of, that's kind of the simplest way of describing what a rave experience could be. And then of course you have people on like different drugs. Like that's, you know, that kind of, that is an element. I always say there's like three elements of the rave scene, and one is music, one is community, and one is drugs. So you have those three things and it can make up a rave.
So one of the fascinating things, right? So you talk about, and you, in your book, there are, you know, it's divided where you will have a specific chapter really dedicated to that rave. And it's interesting because you tell us where it is, who you go with, right? The community, and then what drugs you took. So, right, you have some of, when you say that, it's sort of in there. But, it, you know, what I thought was fascinating was that one of the ways you have remembered or know about this is that you recorded yourself. You know, you have these recordings from a lot of these raves. So could you talk about that, like getting that tape recorder and sort of recording this experience and even listening back to the
house? Oh, yeah, I know. So when I had my light bulb moment and I realized like, oh, you know, I've got all these funny stories and, you know, maybe I should just write them down and see what happens. I also remembered that I documented my experience really well. I actually kept a list of every rave I went to, handwritten with like the name of the rave, the date. I wish I had put where it was, but it was just the name and the date. And I, you know, we took photos, but it was with like disposable cameras. But I have a lot of the photos still. And we also had journals that we wrote. Like I would write my friends' journals at a party. So I had lots of memorabilia, but probably the most important tool that I had that helped me write the book was the dictaphone. So kind of early on, I think I'd only gone to like five raves or so, I found a dictaphone, which is like the little mini handheld recorders, because not everyone knows what they are anymore. Like journalists used to use them a lot, right? I found it in my parents' house and I was like, oh, maybe I'll take this and like record me and my friends and like just for fun. I like was not even thinking, you know, oh, I'm going to be a investigative reporter. So I just started taking it around and interviewing my friends, talking to myself, like listening to, like recording the music that I was playing. If it was like a really good song, sometimes I would forget it was recording and you can just kind of hear like chatter, which is really funny. So I had these tapes and I had recordings from about 20 different raves. So when I got to writing the book, I transcribed the tapes and just saw, okay, what do I have here? And so not only did I have dialogue, authentic dialogue, and like what we talked about when we were totally frying balls, or totally out of our head on ecstasy. Also, I could hear the music again in the background, and that like immediately transported me to the party, which was a really cool method to help write about it, because it's kind of like with music, it's like muscle memory, right? You hear a song and it can like transport you to a memory when you like first heard that song. And so that was a really cool part of the process. And I locked those tapes away. So I was living with my parents. I had a bedroom in my parents' house, and I had a box. It was called the Bad Box, and it was a bank box where I kept all the tapes, and I kept a lot of my like raver memorabilia, and I locked those tapes away and hid them at my parents' house when I went off to college. And so I came home and got those tapes out, and they really helped me write my book. I couldn't have actually written my book without them, I would say. Yeah.
Yes. So, and you talk about you at your parents' house. You're only six. The majority of the book, you're 16, right? And you sort of go between rave culture, but also sort of that home and school and how you sort of balance or sometimes don't balance both, you know, don't balance them. And so one of the things I really appreciated was that look that it wasn't, this is just the rave culture, but like, how do I figure out what it's like to be a teenager also and sort of where I fit in as being a teenager? So could you talk a little bit about that? Because part of this has to do with you not fitting in at school and trying to sort of figure out a place. So what these raves sort of brought for you that you weren't getting outside of that space.
Yeah. Thank you. I think that duality that's what really makes it a coming of age story, because I could have just written a book about a bunch of short stories about like every rave, but I think what that was only 50% of my life, actually not even 50%, although it felt like it was like 100% of my life. I was living under my parents' roof, and I started raving sophomore year of high school. I went to a Catholic high school in Oakland, and no uniforms though, which I was really glad about. You cannot put me in a uniform. And I was already struggling a bit in school. I did the drama club freshman year, sophomore year, because I enjoyed dancing and singing and music. I danced growing up as a little girl. I danced competitively, and I wasn't that interested in sports anymore. I grew up swimming competitively as well. And I don't know, once I got to high school, it's just those hormones. I just like wasn't feeling athletic. I wasn't an athlete. And so I joined the drama club, because that's kind of where a lot of the other creative kids were. And I could sing and I could dance and be a part of this community, like an ensemble. So I really found kind of that was like my first little community was the drama club. But I struggled in school. Like I did fine, like with my grades, but in terms of being inspired, I wasn't really inspired. I didn't have aspirations to be a writer. I actually struggled with reading a bit. I felt like I was a slow reader. So I was not confident in the classroom. I was way more confident in my social life or in drama club. And then I was also kind of exposed to smoking weed and kind of interested in alternative stuff early on from like musical tastes. And so I kind of felt like, you know, a lot of people were into kind of more mainstream things. And I mean, sure, there were some bands and stuff I liked that were mainstream, but I just kind of was interested in things that were a bit more quirky. And a lot of people say that raves were a place where a lot of like outcasts or like people who were, you know, kind of didn't feel like they, you know, belonged in or could find a place of belonging in high school and like thrived because you had the music and you had this other community where it was very accepting as well. You know, I think high school, I don't know if high schools are still like this. I've read a lot of other coming of age stories, but you know, you kind of feel like you have to fit into a category. And you know, you don't really feel like you have to do that after high school, like as you enter adulthood. And so it's really too bad that that kind of comes with the high school territory. So it's kind of this pressure to like know what your interests are and know who you are. And like that's, people don't even really discover that, you know, like until way later. Yeah, so that's why when I found raves, I was just like, whoa, this is a place where I can, you know, I can be really kooky and like feel like I have this freedom of creative exploration that I couldn't find at school in like art class.
Yeah, you know, and one of the things I think that I think maybe also comes out because you are a female writer and you're talking about this is that there's talk about the music and you mentioned some of the DJs, but you also talk a lot about fashion, right? And it takes me back to like thinking about, oh yes, like you talk about sort of the clothing and the attire and the fashion and what that meant and what you were choosing to wear. And also sort of accessories that you had and you brought with. So can you talk a little bit about that and you know, sort of how fashion played a role in sort of some of those choices that you made during that time?
Oh, yes, of course. I'd love to talk about the fashion part. So when I talk about, you know, like not really knowing myself and my interests, actually an early interest of mine was fashion. You know, growing up, I was reading Vogue. I wanted a subscription to Vogue when I was like 9 years old, you know, and that's like very sophisticated for a little girl. And I would play in my mom's jewelry and clothes. And so that was a pretty obvious interest of mine. But again, at my school, like, yeah, I could like dress, you know, cool and play around with clothes, but you kind of get this like reputation as being like maybe more high maintenance or kind of snotty because you're into that. And it's like, that was just my creative expression. So, you know, there weren't a lot of people at my school who dressed interesting. And so I guess like that was one area where I liked to play around. So that was a big interest of mine. And like fashion as well as like beauty and makeup and just all the girly stuff. I was really into it. And so when I found raving, there was this aesthetic that was different. And not everybody adopted the raver style. But what I saw were these giant pants. So like baggy jeans were really popular in the 90s, you know, it was like the saggy, baggy jeans, but these were like pants, like beyond, you know, anything I'd seen. And they were super baggy. I wouldn't even say they weren't baggy. They were wide. So there were these two brands that made a lot of the pants that I was seeing. They were JNCO and Kickwear, and they both were out of Southern California. So these pants were just kind of all over the California rave scene. And the style, it was a style that both girls and boys wore. So it was kind of cool because there was like this androgyny thing happening. And so I immediately picked up on the style and I was like, I'm going to find those pants. And the girls were wearing like sports bras or like, you know, baby tees were really big in the 90s. That was kind of already happening, even from like grunge and stuff. And so the baby tees and sports bras and like crop tops. And so I was already interested in a lot of these street brands. And so I, you know, was definitely had an eye for that in the culture. And then, of course, you had your candy jewelry. And which is candy jewelry has like completely like blown up and is like now like high-end jewelry. You can find high-end candy jewelry. And so I noticed the colorful jewelry that people were wearing and like the visors and the bucket hats. And so, and then three stripes. So Adidas was a really big raver brand. It was really big in Europe. The Raver brand and that, you know, and the three stripes look really cool under the purple lights at a party, you know, they glow. And so I noticed the three stripes everywhere. So I was like, okay, I gotta go get myself some Adidas, these pants. I gotta make some of those bracelets. Like I just like really kind of figured out the style. And so then of course, like if I dressed the part, then I felt like, okay, I fit in. So yeah, so that was the fashion part of it. And, you know, and then I kind of, as I kind of became more of a raver girl, you know, I kind of figured out my own style within that. But, you know, that raver style is very representative of like the American raver. I feel like the East Coast kind of had their own style and then Europe kind of had their own version, but this was very much like the California kid. California raver kid style. Yeah.
And so, right. So you've got the style stuff. And then another thing you do and talk about are the people, right? The people you've met and the people who you went to raves with, and you had certain friends that you spent a lot of time going, you know, that was what you did together and went to raves together. And to the point where you created a color club, which you kept track of. I was like, there's like 150, 200 people. Can you talk about like, you know, I don't know, you don't need to talk about all of it, but are there like certain stories or certain things that like about those communities, those friends and sort of creating that community that was so important to you in that space?
Yeah. So the unique part about the rave scene for me was that my friends at school were very different. I kind of like compartmentalized, like I had my school friends and then my raver friends. And then a couple though of my raver best friends did go to my school. So we were kind of like the token ravers, and you know, the guys would comment on my pants and be like, damn, like your pants are bigger than mine. And like, you know, and so it was like, but by then I was like, whatever, my pants are like super cool. Like, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know fashion. So a couple of my friends were at my school and we kind of represented the ravers at our school, but most of my friends were not at my school. And what was really cool was, it was just, like I said before, it was this melting pot of these kids who didn't feel like they fit in at their school. They couldn't find, you know, their interests. And so they gravitated towards this like underground world. And it was really cool because I grew up in Oakland. And so I have been exposed to, you know, diversity, and, you know, the Bay Area is a kind of melting pot. But So there was a lot of that at Rave, but it was also like it exposed me to friends with different socioeconomic backgrounds. So I went to a private Catholic school, and some of my friends I met, like they, you know, they were nearly high school dropouts and they didn't have the same privilege that I did. And so it was really interesting to kind of just meet these people. And then some of them were older too. So I had some 18-year-old friends, which or 19-year-old friends, which I wouldn't have had at my high school. So it exposed me to people from different socioeconomic backgrounds, from cities like 45 minutes away, and then also slightly older friends who'd kind of been around the block with raving and drugs. And so I learned, you know, I could learn from them. So that was really cool because, you know, and that's one of the things that made it so interesting too, because it was just really broadening my horizons on so many levels. And one of my closest friends was a gay guy, and he was my first gay husband and raver partner in crime. And his journey is really interesting because he, you know, he grew up in Oakland as well, and he came out to his parents when he was really young, when he was like 12. And I, not only was he my first gay, openly gay friend, but my first friend who I had heard of, like that, you know, was that self-aware that they came out, you know, and to their parents about this, because it was the 90s. Like, you did not have many openly gay, like certainly teenagers. And then even in pop culture and stuff, it was like not, you know, Will and Grace was like just around the bend. And that would help to help normalize, you know, LGBT folks. But at the time, like, you know, it's kind of something I like knew about in my periphery. But I didn't have any family or anyone where I could learn about that culture from. And so he taught me a lot. And so he also found in Rave, he found a lot of other friends from the gay community. And that was actually what he, because like we both hid it from our parents. A lot, like we did not think our parents would approve. A lot of parents did, in general, didn't approve. And so he actually explained to his parents like that raving was a place where he felt like he could be himself, and he felt like he had other gay friends, and he wasn't the only gay kid in school. And his parents let him rave after that. And like, that was really, you know, well, I mean, like kudos to his parents, you know, but also like kudos to him for being so self-aware and, you know, truthful and really navigating that to staying true to him. And so he's a really interesting character, and he's still a great friend of mine. And yeah. And then I had, you know, I had some girlfriends in the book and guy friends and mixed friends. And it was really an interesting, lots of interesting characters.
Yes. No, there's a point where you're like, oh, I'd love to see what this person is doing now, right? Like that book, it has a feel of that. Like, oh, you know, hope everybody made it where they need to be. Another thing you do is that I think is really unique, and not a lot of women do it, is write about drugs. And in a way, right? And not just, we have a lot, you know, with, you know, legalizing weed and all that everywhere. We have a lot of that. But it's not, right? It's thinking about acid and ecstasy and talking about what that experience is like. And so I don't know the best way to ask this, but like, what was that like writing about that experience to sort of present it, but you not presenting it in presenting it in more of a, this is what it was like for me, and this is what the experience was, and here's how it was really a part of this scene. And like I said, I think it's pretty unique to, especially female writers, right? We don't see a lot of more hard drug cult writing.
Yeah. Yeah, there's actually a book on my to-read list that is actually about women writing about their psychedelic experiences. So you can find it, but I feel like it's definitely still indie. Writing my different drug experiences was interesting because, you know, I just like be like, okay, today I'm going to sit down and write about that, you know, super fun time on mushrooms when we decorated a parking meter, which is like, it's so random. But because we took mushrooms, it actually made it this like really wild experience where we got to explore the drug and do something that if we weren't on the drug would not have been as exciting. So sitting down to write it was tricky. I have to say sometimes it was really fun. And sometimes it was really grueling, depending on the drug. And, you know, I just wanted to be as truthful and authentic to my experience, which definitely took multiple drafts. But I remember sometimes, you know, writing about an experience and like breaking out in a sweat. And like breaking out in a sweat, feeling like my heart, like starting to like beat, you know, out of my chest, and like feeling actually this like physical reaction. And again, I feel like it's that kind of muscle memory for good or bad, because I'd have to like go outside and like take a break and go for a walk. And it was like it's really kind of ingrained in my cells, I feel like. And so when you revisit that, like it kind of came out. And like sometimes I remember if I would like be reading a certain chapter, like if I was reading the chapter on, you know, when I did crystal meth for the first time, like it's a hard read for me. Like I did not enjoy writing those chapters as much. But those, you know, that was part of my trajectory, and I had to write about those experiences. And there was writing it, and then there was even reading it. Sometimes I'd be like, oh, I have to like edit this chapter, and I don't feel like reading it. And so I'd have to be in the right space, like mentally, to be able to tackle certain chapters. But then like the chapter where I took ecstasy for the first time, which was actually not at a rave, it was supposed to be, but the rave got shut down. But we still got our ecstasy in the parking lot. Like that chapter was so fun to write, and because it was such a like blissful, beautiful experience, and that's still like actually one of my favorite chapters from the book. And so that one was like fun to write, easy to write. So I would say it kind of goes with the drug experience. You know, if I had a good trip, it was a fun chapter to write. If I had a bad trip, it was a challenge to write.
You know, not only with like the fun trips or not so fun trips, you also sort of talk about the beauty of rave culture, but some of the not, you know, so you don't sort of glamorize it all. Right. So there was a incident on, was it a boat, like a boat in the water? Right. So there was a big incident there. And so you sort of, you know, let the reader know that, you know, there's these great things, there's these other things, you wouldn't trade it, but it, you know, it wasn't all just 24/7 excitement.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not the only one who burnt out. And I feel like those of us who got really engaged with the scene, a lot of us burnt out. And so like any kind of drug story, there are highs and lows. I feel like you read the first half of the book and you're like, woohoo, I want to go to a rave. I want a candy flip. Like, I want to do all this. This sounds so fun. And I was like, I have a responsibility here. to like, you know, to tell the other side of the coin. So I'd say, yeah, that second half of the book is like the dark side. And, you know, and that's also how things unraveled for me. Because when you kind of go to the dark side of a, you know, a subculture, and you get into the harder drugs and you start hanging out with the shady people, and like that's inevitably when like, yeah, the shady stuff's going to happen. So that's what happened to me. And so, you know, it's a cautionary tale, I feel like, because it's, you know, it's like, okay, well, you can try these things, but like this can happen, but this can also happen. And, you know, that's kind of why, you know, now there's so many more resources than when in the 90s in terms of harm reduction and drug education. And I actually list those in my book, and organizations like Dance Safe, which are awesome. Dance Safe actually started in the late 90s. In the San Francisco Bay Area. And so these are organizations that provide drug testing kits and, you know, all kinds of, you know, reading about the drugs. And so people can make more informed decisions, because it's like, sometimes like this was my personality. Like I had an experimental, or I have an experimental personality. And so, you know, I don't think there was really any stopping me experimenting with this stuff. So I think it's great now that there are these tools for for adults, and certainly for, you know, young, the youth, and people can make more, you know, conscientious choices and more informed choices.
Yeah, and it seems like you were with a group of people, at least for the most part, that were also invested in taking care of each other. Which is really important in situations where you're, especially if you're going to do psychedelic drugs, right? You need someone who you can trust to be there with you.
Yes. I mean, it's there's sometimes some settings I would not recommend. In a rave setting doesn't sound like the best setting to lots of people, but there was rarely any fights. There were rarely any, if there was an overdose, there was a bunch of people there to help with the overdose, and as well as the people who were throwing the party. So you didn't have Dance Safe there in the 90s, but you had your friends, you had your community, and, you know, now there are like medic teams and all kinds of that at like the huge festivals, which is great and necessary. But yeah, we did look out for each other. And it was also just because, you know, there were rarely security guards, and you didn't really want to attract the attention of the security guard or, you know, the police. So that was kind of the beautiful part of the community, was, you know, we all looked out for each other. And I had a bad trip. Like I witnessed bad trips. I didn't witness, but I was present for a couple deaths. And, you know, it was kind of like we all had to band together, because we also didn't want the police to find out, because, you know, that did inevitably happen, because scenes got bigger around the country, and you did start hearing about more deaths and overdoses, and kind of, you know, that contributed to the demise of raves how they were in the 90s. But yeah, that was a beautiful part of it. We were definitely there for each other. We had each other's backs.
Yeah, you know, and there's just one other, there's many things I could talk to you about, but one thing in particular that I kind of loved is the amount that you and your friends groups were able to kind of, the amount of scheming you did to be able to get to the raves, right? It was pretty, and I think some of it had to do with that time period, but I will just say that I really loved reading about some of the elaborate planning it took to just even get there, right? Because the rave isn't going to start until midnight, so.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you didn't, I mean, I did have some friends who had really lax parents. And so they didn't have to like do all the scheming that me and my Casey, who is my gay husband, that we had to do around our parents. And sometimes we got, you know, found out because, like, you know, it's parents are not, if parents are keeping an eye on you, like, they're going to, you know, they're going to want to know what you're doing. And yeah, so the book goes into, you know, kind of how we navigated when the parents did find out, and like, did we lie? Did we confess? Which I think is all very like teenager, you know, and all the different degrees of like that complex relationship with the parents. I sadly never felt like I could really tell my parents what I was doing. They were very supportive and loving. But I was just like totally closed off. I just did not think they would approve. I started meeting with a therapist when I was like getting grounded all the time, and like they were like, okay, if you're not going to talk to us, like, how we're going to get you a therapist. So like there's a professional who can help you, you know, navigate this time. And that was actually really beneficial and really helpful. And I still have therapy and believe in it. And I actually still have that therapist from that time, which is really cool. My same therapist in Oakland who knows me so well. And so I feel like there were some friends whose parents did not even know or care, which is like a whole nother, you know, issue. And then we were kind of on the other end of the spectrum. But, you know, we didn't have these parents who were authoritarian and just wanted to like lock us up, because like that would have just been made, that would have made it worse, honestly. I would have like run away or something. So it's really interesting how my parents and I navigated it. And the scheming was necessary in order, you know, I was fighting for my right to party. But I think it was maybe a certain point where maybe it wasn't as necessary, and I probably could have opened up to them a bit more. But honestly, I think by then I was depressed. I think kind of all the, this is the second half of the book where kind of all the drugging and the partying was really starting to affect my mood. And I was in a depression and I was not making the best decisions. And so that probably wouldn't have been a good time to open up to them. So I do have regrets about that, because especially when Casey opened up to his parents, and I, you know, I was like, like he opened up to his parents, can I do that? And I just like didn't have the guts. So
we've been talking, you know, for a while about this, and I could probably talk to you for a while longer, but I'm sure you have something else to do. But do you, this just came out, right?
Yeah, like, came out a couple weeks ago.
Right. So I was asked if you have anything you want to plug, if you're working on something new you want to plug, or if there's something with this book that you're sort of working on and kind of want to promote or put out there.
Well, thank you so much. I've enjoyed talking to you too. And it's great. I love that you brought up the Color Club, because no one's brought up the Color Club yet.
But there's a whole list of them. How can
I
you not?
I know, but you know, everyone, like, there's lots of stuff to talk about, right? So thank you for recognizing the Color Club, because that we were very proud of it.
You should be. I love that you made cards for them too. Like, I'm like, it was like you were all in.
The membership card. Yeah. I mean, that's where like my dad's entrepreneurial spirit kind of came in for me. So the book came out October 12th. And I'm working on other freelance work, because I am a freelance writer. So if anyone needs help with writing in, you know, lots of different capacities, whether it's with a book manuscript or editing, I'm also an editor. But for me, like, the art is in the editing. I enjoy writing, but You know, I think anyone who's written a book knows it takes a lot of revision. And for me, like, the art is in the revision. So I enjoy editing if anyone needs editing help. But no, I'm not. I mean, I guess I'm kind of fantasizing about some second book ideas, but I think it's more just going to be about what's my next big creative project. And I don't know if that's a book or what. So it's, you know, it's been 8 years working on Raver Girl. So I'm kind of just enjoying the ride, the come down from the launch. And, you know, I'm excited to hear what everybody thinks about it. So thank you. Thank you for sharing your thoughts. And it was great. It was really interesting to hear what you picked up on, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's really fun, and well, we talked about this a little before, but I always appreciate when there's like a female point of when we hear stories from what people perceive to be male-dominated subcultures from people, you know, who don't necessarily identify as male. So,
yeah, and I mean, you know, when I was writing my book, I read a lot of the books. But I guess I can plug a couple. There's another book called Rave Art, which is by a British woman. And she was a part of the scene, like the original scene in the 80s. And so she has a book called Rave Art. She actually was also a collector of memorabilia. And she kept all her flyers in like pristine shape. And so she has an awesome book out called Rave Art, if you're interested in mine. And then there's also, just to shout out to the other ladies, voices in this world, there's also a podcast called Rave to the Grave, which is all about rave culture. And it's hosted by a DJ from back in the day, named Star Eyes. And yeah, so I feel like let's just like collectively as women start to like tell our stories and share our stories and not be afraid, because, you know, I think we all know that drugs are are complex, and not be afraid to tell your stories. It's a free world, I feel like, in terms of, you know, everything that's happening with cannabis and now, you know, all the research and everything that's going into psychedelic therapy, and it's an exciting time. I'm just glad we have more resources now to be able to do it in safe environments, and, you know, there's like guides, and I feel like the future of, you know, of that is really exciting. So that's what I'm watching.
No, yes. And it will be right. We are starting to think about and study and look at, I mean, and people have been looking at it for a long time, but it's becoming more, I don't know if mainstream is the right word.
I think it is becoming mainstream, because have you read or seen Nine Perfect Strangers?
I've heard about it. I haven't.
Yeah. Like, she, you know, it's talking about microdosing at wellness retreats. And, like, that's pretty mainstream, if you ask me. It's a Hulu, you know, it's Leanne Mortieri's book, and Nine Perfect Strangers, and they adapted it to a Hulu show. And, it reveals, you know, a bit about this world of microdosing, different plant medicines. I'll just say that. I don't want to give away too much.
Awesome. Well, like you said, exciting. It's been really great talking to you again, Samantha Durbin, who wrote Raver Girl, Coming of Age in the 90s. Samantha, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. Thank you. It was fun.